You know, in looking back over this recording, it may sound rather harsh, my dealings with Mr. Zucker and maybe other business associates, but it must be borne in mind that an actor's life, at best, is very short-lived. One of many things can happen to him, loss of health. But the greatest menace, of course, is the loss of popularity. And so he must make hay while the sun shines. And in wanting my pictures to be sold to the exhibitors individually was fair and right. I did not want to be sold along with 8 or 10 ordinary pictures that the exhibitors might not want. In fact, very often flatly refused. I don't say that Paramount or any company that I was associated with deliberately undersold me, but it's impossible in a worldwide organization to control the salesman, and you can understand, to the salesman's point of view. He is given a quota on each picture, and if he walks into an exhibitor and says, I have 10 pictures here that I want to sell you, and the exhibitor said, no, I don't want the 10. I only want the 2 top ones. Well, naturally, the salesman cannot go back to his superior and say, I only sold the 2 successful ones. With a lift of the eyebrow, with a little gesture, he might say the following, well, I know you're my friend and I'm yours. You've got to help me out in this thing. I cannot go back and say I've failed. But you take care of these 8 pictures and I will be reasonable with the 2 that you want. That, in a nutshell, is what I try to avoid, and only partially, even with my own company, was I able to do so. It goes on today, and of course, a tremendous loss to anyone that is fortunate enough or unfortunate enough to have a great success. And it requires tremendous vigilance on the part of a producer to see that his product is safeguarded against this menace. And it's interesting to note, after all these years, that the industry now is emulating the original idea of Artcraft. Pictures sold individually, the actors, actresses, great producers forming their own companies, and seeing to it that the pictures are fairly and properly sold, exhibited. I have never been of the opinion, nor am I now, that any one individual should, attempt to take all of the profits. I think everybody should have a share. I think that we all need an incentive. And then with taxes such as they are today, the capital gain tax is the only hope of putting money away for our children, for our future and our old age. And I'm well aware of that fact. And it makes me, I won't say laugh exactly, because it was no laughing matter. Since this is not for public consumption and is for history, for the Eastman House, I may seem a little bit indelicate when I say that I received $1,040,000 for 2 years' work. And, of course, that was when a dollar was a dollar, not 25 cents as it is today. They say, oh, Mary, you made your big money before taxation. I had 1 year in 1916, but in 1917, I paid the government out of the million, or the, rather the $520,000, I paid $250,000 tax. Then I had earned $40,000 in 1916, and Mr. Zucker asked me to accommodate him by putting it over into 1917, which of course I agreed. Well, the government said, although I'd earned it in 16, I had to pay the tax in 1917. And the result was that of that $40,000, I paid $27,000 tax, which left me 13. And I hope that anyone who's interested in my career, which was, of course, amazing, but not nearly as amazing as the people of today. For example, for that $1,040,000, I made 13 pictures. A certain star today, very handsome, a male star, is demanding $750,000 for one picture. And when I got the $10,000 a week, Mr. Zucker shared dollar for dollar with me. In other words, my $10,000 a week was a drawing account against my 50% of the profits. When the profits, when that was realized, then Mr. Zucker got his $520,000, and then we split equally. But of course, Mr. Zucker, unlike myself, had other pictures in the company, other interests, whereas I only had one. So that also must be taken into account. I am proud of the fact that I paved the way for my fellow artists, but I regret that they are not more generous with the people that are putting up the money and running the tremendous risk. Because today, when you're putting in millions of dollars and you don't know whether you're going to get it back or not, I think that anybody who is going along with the producer should bear a little of the risk. That's all right. Mr. DeMille told me the other day, I sat next to him at a luncheon at the Beverly Hills Hotel. He told me that the picture cost the great Ten Commandments, the last one he made, $13,500,000. But he said if it were made in the United States, it would have cost 50. But it's expected to do $100 million in gross. And you know what that darling has done? He's given it all to charity. He's not touching one penny of it. The company gets back his $13,500,000, and if I recall correctly, 40% is given to Mr. DeMille's foundation. Now there's a great man in his late 70s. And when they talk about us here in Hollywood, they omit such wonderful people like DeMille. He's one of the finest metaphysicians I've ever met. He knows the Bible from cover to cover. And I doubt that he's just as conversant with all of the great philosophical and metaphysical books and works as he is of the Bible. He's a great credit to us. And I knew him, of course, when I was a little girl. And with each year, he's grown in stature. And I'm very proud that I may call him a friend. He wrote me, or for me, a tribute in my book, not Why Not Try God. That was another book. No, Sunshine and Shadow. And to know that the great Cecil B. DeMille thinks so kindly of me is really heartwarming and something to be very, very proud of.
Thank you for this very stirring summing up, Miss Pickford. After this, I almost hesitate to bring you back to 1921. But would you tell us about an instance involving Gertrude Astor during the making of Through the Back Door?
Oh, yes, I remember how beautiful she was, and I'm no doubt still is beautiful. I haven't seen her in many years. But it was always my custom to remain off the set when other actresses, especially in their first scenes, were performing. Because I was not alone actress, but you see, I was producer as well. And anybody my size, at that time weighing 98 pounds, I don't know why I should frighten them, but seemingly I did. So the director called me. This picture was titled Through the Back Door. And I'm sorry to say I wrote it myself. Yes, but I never took credit for any of the things I wrote because it was enough that I was producing and acting in them. And I used my grandmother's name, Catherine Hennessy, most of the time. Of course, I had help, you know, in the scenario. But the idea was mine originally. And I worked also with the writers. But to go back to Miss Astor, the director called me in the dressing room and he said, "Miss Pickford, we're in great trouble." He said, "Miss Astor's been on this one scene, a close-up, at the telephone since 9 o'clock, and it's nearly 12. And I don't know what to do with her. Frankly, I don't know. Will you come over?" So I walked on the stage, and the look she gave me, if I had been a lion, I'm sure it would not have terrified her more. And why, I don't know, because I had certainly been polite and kind as I knew how. So I conferred with the director, and I said, "Now I want you to alert the cameraman and the electricians, because I'm sure you're going to get your scene." So I walked over to her and put my arm around her shoulder, and I said, "I know exactly how you feel." She said, "I just can't cry, Miss Pickford. I cannot cry." Well, I said, "I've been in that same position, and I know just how you feel." I knew she wanted me to help her in some way, and I thought, well, self-pity probably is the best approach. So I said, "Of course, we'll have to do the scenes over that you have already photographed." But I said, "That's all right. That happens, you know." But I said, I just feel terribly to have to take you out of this role. I said that we'll do everything we can to protect you. Through the press in every way. But I said, you know, and it was the truth also. It was the truth because there were enough people on the set that would have spread the story all over the place because in those days and today, it's a small village, you know, and you know what's the industry as a family knows what's going on. When I told her that we'd have to replace her, she started to cry. And she wept, and of course the camera started grinding, and the director was pleased, and she was pleased, and I was too, and she came over and gave me a very tearful, very wet embrace, a kiss, and said, "Thank you for helping me. I couldn't have done it without you."
Did the dual role in Little Lord Fauntleroy give you a great deal of trouble working with the double exposures and so forth?
Yes, because you see, it wasn't worked out as it is today, with all the mechanical improvements. For instance, where Cedric, little Lord Fauntleroy, kisses his mother dearest, I think it took something like 3 or 4 seconds on the screen. It took me 24 hours to accomplish that seeming miracle of kissing my own cheek.
now we come to a film that is very close to my heart. And would you please speak of Rosita as if it was one of your favorite films of history?
Well, now you ask me the impossible. I promised you, and I will keep that promise, that you may have a copy of it. That is, if I have it, I may have it. I'm sure I do. And I trust that it's in good condition. Well, I was approaching that time where I could not, at least I felt so, continue in the role of a little girl. This was back in 1922. I had already done the second Tess of the Storm Country, and I wanted to do a grown-up role. I wanted to do an adult woman. I had seen some of the work of Ernst Lubitsch, I think the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. Didn't he direct that?
No, but he directed the Polonaise, Madame Du Barry.
Well, Madame Du Barry, but there was another one he did, too. But we were getting some very fine pictures from Germany. So I negotiated with him and succeeded in having a contract signed. And I sent him, before signing the contract, the story of Dorothy Byrne of Haddon Hall. And he agreed to do it. In the meantime, when he was on the high seas, I went to the stadium here, the Veterans Stadium, without mentioning the general's name. There was quite a big gathering, and this man got up. He was the head of the Legion of Honor, and he made one of the most intolerant speeches I had ever heard. He said that they were bringing a German singer to this country. Now, mind you, this was 4 years after the war. He said they are bringing this German opera singer to this country. He said, why? We have plenty of Americans who sing just as well and better. And he said, I would, and I'm quoting him verbatim, to God that you men out there who have fought in World War would meet the Kaiser's son, because it's said that he's coming here too, and to shoot him dead. Well, my blood ran cold. I thought, he's going to turn on me and say to me, to the audience, there sits a traitor. Why is she bringing Ernst Lubitsch here? Are there not enough American directors? Are there not enough directors of our allies that she must bring an enemy here? Then I began to get really hot under the collar. And I thought, well, if he does point to me, I'm going to say, well, General, sir, the war is over. And since when has art a boundary line? This is a great man. This is a great director and will be something for the industry, not alone the United States, but the world, to be proud of. Certainly I'm bringing him here. And I'm really shocked that 4 years after the war, that I should have to sit here and listen to such intolerance and to such bigotry and such ignorance. Unfortunately, I was not called upon. I had to eat my speech and leave the platform without ever having to defend the people that wanted to reach hands across the ocean and to bring together a beautiful result. And I had then, still do, great respect and admiration for Ernst Lubitsch. He was not a soldier, and even if had he been, and if I had been, we couldn't help the war. We had to do what our countries told us to do. But I went away from there so shaken and so nervous that I sat down and discussed it with my mother, which I always did, because she was a very wise woman. And she said, well, I think probably it's best for everyone concerned that there be no fanfare for Ernst Lubitsch's arrival. So his attorney, who happened to be Charlie Chaplin's attorney, Nathan Burkhand, And he went out on the pilot ship, met Lubitsch, took him off the ship. And it might be funny, unless it, to me it's almost tragic. I want to cry when I think of it. Here's this German coming to the United States for the first time. And he had gold teeth in the front of his mouth. And he had on peg-top trousers. And he had lemon, banana, yellow boots, shoes. So the first thing Mr. Burkhan said to him, he said, "You've got to get rid of those shoes." He said, "Why? I bought them in Berlin, very expensive." He said, "I know, but we don't wear them in the United States." And he said, "Those trousers with the peg top," he says, "the finest tailor in Berlin." He said, "I'm sorry, Ernst." He said, "No." And he said, "I'm going to get my dentist," he said, "to take out those gold teeth and replace them with porcelain teeth." He said, "Now you're going too far." And of course, he spoke with a very broad German accent. But anyhow, all three things were accomplished. And poor Ernst Lubitsch arrived in Hollywood not knowing what kind of a demon I was. And at that time, we had a very dear friend of Douglas Fairbanks and mine, a great writer, who wrote My Lady's Dress, Milestones, Kismet, Edward Knobloch, who spoke beautiful French and just as perfect German. Of course, Ernst only had very few words in English. So I remember I met him out on the lot, and I said, "Welcome, Mr. Lubitsch. Welcome to California. Welcome to our studio. I'm very proud that you came over." And I took his hand, and he shook it, and he was very naturally, being an artist, very sensitive, and he was deeply hurt. And he shook my hand and threw it away as though it were a hot potato. And he went away with Knobloch. He said, "Mein Gott," he said, "she is cult." And Knobloch said, "Oh, no, she's not." He said, "Yeah, she's cult. How can she be an actress and be so cult?" Because, of course, he was smarting under his teeth being taken out and naturally losing his shoes and his trousers. Then, a few days later, I saw him going through this wheat field, and it's now all built up. And where Douglas had built the castle for Robin Hood. And he was swimming through it with all these wild gestures. And I said to my mother, "There goes trouble." I got back to the bungalow, and Knobloch came in. And he said, "Mary, I'm sorry to tell you, Lubitsch will have nothing to do with Dorothy Vernon of Haddon Hall." Well, it was a blow in the face. I had spent $250,000 on the story and preparation, and that would be over $1 million today. And I said, "Well, that's too bad." So I said, "Will you ask him to come in and talk to me?" And I said, "I'd like to be alone with him." So he came in, and he was white, and his hands were perspiring when he shook hands with me. And I said, "I hear you don't do Dorothy Vernon." And he said, "Nein, not for $1 million. I said, "All right, Mr. Lubitsch." I said, I wouldn't go against your good judgment. I said, "What's the matter? What's the matter with the story?" He said, "Too many queens." He meant queens. "Not enough queens. I won't do it." What he meant was that the story of Mary, Queen of Scots, and Elizabeth of England was so great a story in itself that there was no room for Dorothy Vernon. And that's what he meant, too many queens and not enough queens. Well, I said, I, as terribly disappointed as I am, I see your point of view. But let's not get excited about it. If you don't want it, I'm sorry. But let's try to find another story. So in the meantime, he'd been going around the wall with his hands crossed in back of him, and he was perspiring so that he left a festoon of little... He was a small man, you know, and had little fat hands, and they were wet, and he left a festoon of his hand marks around my freshly painted dove gray wall, and I kept watching that, and I really believe I was more disturbed about those hand marks than I was about Dorothy being turned down. So he went out to Knobloch, who was waiting anxiously outside. He said, "Mein Gott, nein, nur she's coat." He said, "A necklace." He said, she took it, standing up. She didn't say one word. And Knobloch said, "Oh, no, she's disturbed." And he said, "You don't know American actresses." He said, they save their acting for the stage and the screen. No, he said, "No, she's cult. She can't act." He said, "I'm telling you," she can't act. He said, "Why don't you wait till you get her before the camera, and then you'll see." So weeks went by, and nothing would... Well, he tried, for instance, to get me to do Faust, and I regret that I didn't do it. But my mother heard him from the other room saying, "This, Miss Pickford, is the sense where you strangle the baby." He meant this is the scene where you strangle a baby. So when he left, my mother, who never interfered with me, the business was her department, mine was the artistic, of course I always consulted her. Outside of being very strict with me about being perfectly moral and never doing anything salacious or suggestive, she never interfered. So she said, "What did he say? Isn't this child illegitimate?" I said, "Yes, Mother." And she said, "He is suggesting that you strangle your illegitimate baby." Well, I said, "Mother, he's a European." She said, "You're an American. You're a Canadian. You're an American. You're an English-speaking woman. I absolutely forbid you doing that picture. And I've never said that to you before, and I hope I'll never have to do it again." I said, "All right, Mother, I won't do it." Well, of course, Lubitsch hit the ceiling. When I didn't give him the reason for it, I just said I didn't want to do it. Well, finally, I should remember, it's a classic, the story that Rosita is based on. No, it's a very famous, it's a classic. But what Lubitsch tried to do was to reform. You see, he had, again, being a European, he liked to do naughty and suggestive things. He tried to be as moral as he knew how, and I tried to be slightly naughty. And I've always felt that the result was pretty terrible. I hope I'm wrong. I think that the costuming, I think the decor, I think the sets are magnificent, and so was the photography. I didn't like myself as Rosita. I couldn't accept it. And then Lubitsch and I, while I tried to give him full rein, I said I've never interfered with a man's prerogative. I don't think that a woman should do that. Of course, being a producer, I could and had to, in my dressing room or in the office, say there has to be one supreme head, and when it comes to an issue, I am that head. So he got so excited, he said, "Knobloch, was ist das?" So he explained to him in German. He said, "Nein, not for $1 million. Not for $1 million. I had walked out after I said it. I said, "Mr. Lubitsch, I will never interfere with you on the set. I will never gainsay you. I'll never criticize anything you have to say or do. But if it comes to an issue, after all, it is I have to put the money up, and it's my career. And I will be glad to arbitrate it. I'll be glad to bring in a person that you and I both respect. But you are not the court of last appeal. And I must say this before we start. I have gone along with you. I have spent $250,000 on Dorothy Byrne. And I've shelved it. This is the story you want to do. So when I left the office, he tore every button, and I mean every button, off his clothing. And that was before zippers, if you know what I mean. And I mean that. Not alone that, but he pounced on Edward Knobloch's papers, some of which he had no copies, and tore them into 100 pieces, threw them in the air, danced around, and said he was going back to Germany. But Knobloch, who was a very persuasive individual, said that I was within reason. He knew me well, that I would not be unreasonable, and that he was being very foolish. With the result that we went ahead and made the picture, but it wasn't easy for me. There was one scene with Holbrook Blinn where he's the king, and he's supposed to say, "Rosita, where is the dagger?" So Lubitsch, being an actor himself, which I think is a great mistake for a director ever to be an actor, because they visualize themselves in all the male roles and they're no good for the female roles. So he came up to me. No, he said to Holbrook Blinn, he said, "Now," he said, "I want that you should say to her, 'Rosita, where is the danger? Where is the danger with the jewels? Where is the dagger with the jewels?'" So Holbrook Blinn, that had a fiendish sense of humor, looked at me with a perfectly straight face and said, "Rosita, there is the danger amid the jewels." With, of course, the result that I started to laugh in a dramatic, terribly dramatic scene. Lubitsch said, "Stop," to the camera. "Why is it to laugh, please, Miss Pickford?" Well, I said, "I don't know. I feel silly this morning, Mr. Lubitsch. Please, be serious. Come, now. You say, there is the danger amid the jewels. Please, come." We took the scene about 10 times until I said, "Please, please, Holbrook, don't do that to me anymore. He's getting very angry. He'll throw the camera at me next." We finally got the scene without the danger amid the jewels. But this went on all through the picture. And, well, I don't know. I think it was my fault and not Lubitsch's. And so I am turning it over with great reluctance to Eastman House, and when you see it, be tolerant with me and know that I was trying to be as naughty as I knew how, and he was trying to be good, and well, we just didn't seem to get together, but I was very proud of the fact that I was able to bring him to this country. There were no bad effects. I mean, no one criticized him nor me. And I'm glad that that poor general, who's sick in the head, I think, somebody must have, in the vernacular of the poets, must have conked him. And if they didn't, they should have. So that's so much for Rosita.
Miss Pickford, wasn't there talk of some project around this time of Charlie directing you and Mademoiselle de Maupin? Didn't he himself want to direct you in a mature part? Do you recall anything about that?
No, you're asking about Charlie Chaplin.
Yes.
No. Oh, back in 1916, his brother Sid came to New York, just about the time I was doing Poor Little Rich Girl. And Charlie had an idea called Bread, B-R-E-A-D. And he wanted to work. He wanted to co-star with me. And believe it or not, I was highly insulted. I thought that pie-throwing individual, because he wasn't considered the great artist that he became later, he offered me the same salary I was getting, $10,000 a week for 4 weeks. But I thought, what in the world would I be doing with a man of his caliber? And I said, "I'm sorry." I said, "I'm not a comedian. Tell your brother that I thank him, and I don't think I could be relieved of my contract anyhow." But that was the only time that was any talk of Charlie. So he was directing me.
Well, then you went ahead and finally did make Dorothy Vernon, didn't you?
Yes, I made it with Mickey Nealon. And it was a very... I liked doing it. Because, of course, I love England. And I happen to know Lady Diana Manners, who was the direct descendant of Dorothy Vernon. Mm-hmm. You see, John Manners. Mm-hmm. See, Dorothy Vernon married John Manners. And Lady Diana Manners was the, I don't know how many generations. And I went to Haddon Hall, and I can't tell you what a thrill it was after having reproduced it on the lot.
And then came Little Annie Rooney.
Well, that was an amusing story. Already people were grumbling and not liking what I had done. They didn't like Rosita. They didn't like too much Dorothy Vernon. It was a disappointment. It was a very expensive picture. And so I thought, well, I have to go back to the little girl whether I like it or not. So I remember walking around the sets. And if you've ever been around sets, you know what a lonesome sort of a haunted place it is. New York streets, the Bowery, you know, Fifth Avenue, small town churches, and deserted, nobody there. And I thought, well, what in the world am I going to do? And the inner voice said, well, you're part Irish, aren't you? I said, that I am. Said, well, who do you know that's Irish? I said, I know Mabel Normand. Said, all right now. You're the producer of Mabel Normand's next picture. What would you do about it? I said, well, I'd certainly get something Irish. Like what, for instance? Well, I'd get a very Irish title like, oh, Little Annie Rooney. I said to myself, that's it. Little Annie Rooney. We wrote the story, maybe it shows today. 1 week out here on the lawn, and one more week, because we were pressed for time, in order to get a good release at the proper time of the year. And there were about six or eight of us. Sat around, we had sandwiches sent out. We'd start at 9, worked till 5 or 6. And Little Annie Rooney was the result.
Who was in the group, Miss Pickford, that wrote?
Tim Whalen, who's now passed on, turned out to be a very good director, and a man by the name of O'Neill. They were gag men, you know. And there's another man whose name I don't recall. There were three gag men, Hope Loring and Louis Lighton. And the director was Bill Bodine.
Then Bill Bodine and you worked on another film that came immediately afterward called Sparrows, and that's one of my great favorites.
That was my story, too.
Oh, was that? Did you originally call it Human Sparrows, or was that a...
Well, that was, they called it that in England, I think, Human Sparrows.
I always worried about you in the scene where you were crossing over the swamp on the limb which was sinking.
Well, do you know that I did it six times?
No. Tell us about that.
Well, there were about, I'd say, in all, about a dozen alligators. And you know, the most vicious ones are the young ones, around 60 to 75 to 85 years of age. The older ones are sort of sluggish. But the young ones can kill you with their tail if they don't bite you, you know, they can, oh. And I said I wouldn't go over it unless I could do it. It was a plank, about, oh, so wide, would you say 5 inches, six,
yeah.
About 6 inches. And a rough plank, I had to go over in my bare knees and carry this. I weighed at the time 100 pounds, and the baby weighed 33 pounds, so she was a third of my weight. So I said I'd go over with a doll, see if I could hold on. And it was torture with bare feet and bare knees and the weight. Of course, the doll wasn't as heavy as the baby, and she had no fear of the alligators. My name was Mama Molly, if you remember.
Yes.
And she'd point at them as though they were kittens, and she'd say, "Ah, Aggie, Mama my, Aggie." And she put her full weight on me. And, oh, I'd be so tired at night, my back, she was strapped on my back, you know. So Douglas Fairbanks heard about it. And he was a very gentle, charming person. But he came down there like a wild, wounded bull. He was so angry with everybody on the set for allowing me to do this. Why, he said, "Don't you know you can do that in double exposure? Do it without the alligators underneath and put the alligators in after with a double exposure," which happened. But I actually went over those 12 alligators 6 times. And that's the truth.
That was the real thing.
That was the real thing.
Then after this came My Best Girl, and I think around that time you must have met Buddy Randolph.
Yes, I did. That was a grown-up story, and that also I collaborated on. Because it was very difficult for me to find stories. In fact, it still is. It amuses me that all the years ago, people were always complaining they couldn't find material. And you know that one of the either Cresses or Krenskys married a girl in the 5 and 10 cent store? Right after we made the picture. And then the song came out, you know, "I Married a $1 Billion Baby in the 5 and 10 cent store." Well, Buddy was and still is a country boy. And he had just come from, he was with Paramount. He had already done Wings and one or two other pictures. He was in college when some friend of his father's in Olathe, Kansas, suggested Buddy to Paramount for their school. They had about a dozen young people. Pardon me. And they asked him if he would take a test. Well, he didn't want to do it because he was afraid that the boys in his fraternity house would make fun of him. He's a Phi Psi. He was going to KU. And he won the scholarship. And he went back to New York went through the paces, I don't know what all they taught him. And Hope Loring, the one that helped be on, she also helped on My Best Girl, she and her husband, said, "I saw a young man last night. I think it was at the Mayfair Club." And she said, "I've taken the liberty of asking him to come up and see you." Well, at the time, I was undecided between Buddy and a man called Donald Cook. So the two of them made the test, and the consensus of opinion was that Buddy should play the role. And then I knew him off and on for 10 years before we were married. I met his family, of course, knew Mrs. Rogers. Judge Rogers was a probate judge of Olathe, Kansas, and just the nicest American family that anybody could meet.
I think just before perhaps making My Best Girl, or perhaps at the same time while you were working on it, you did a little bit in a Fairbanks picture called The Gaucho. Didn't you play the Madonna in a sequence?
That was a very sweet compliment, I thought. It was a very tiring thing. I stood on this pedestal. It was my own idea. It was in color, you know, and I wanted it blue and white. And they just got material. And the wardrobe mistress pinned it on me. And I couldn't sit down. And you know, I stood on that pedestal until my feet and legs were so numb. I didn't know that that could happen to you. But they had to pick me down. They had to pick me up and put me on the floor and unpin me. And I couldn't move. But I thought it was a beautiful, beautiful compliment.
Yes, it's a very lovely sequence. And that reminds me to ask you if you were in the habit of playing bits in each other's pictures in those days.
No, I just played a bit for, let's see, who was it? It was Mary Astor. It might have been. Who played in, was it The Gaucho? No.
Yeah.
The Black Pirate.
Oh, That was Billy Duff.
Billy Duff. Yeah. That's right. Well, she went away, and I put a black wig on and turned my back, and the last scene in the picture, Douglas threw his arms around me and kissed me.
And that's you.
That was I.
And not Billy.
No. And then Douglas pinch-hit for my brother-in-law, Alan Forrest, who married my sister Lottie, and she, too, you know, was in Dorothy Vernon of Haddon Hall, and he... We wanted a big, muscular, athletic back, and my ex-brother-in-law didn't happen to possess that, among other gifts. He was a very handsome man, and so Douglas sat in for him.
Turnabout is fair play.
That's right.
Then now we come to Coquette, and for Coquette, I believe you received an Academy Award, and this is still a most impressive performance, believe me. Screened quite recently at the Dryden Theater, three times, I believe, on one weekend. Would you tell us a little about tackling the problems of working with sound?
Well, naturally, I think my voice is too young for my age, and it was then. Of course, I can change it if I'm conscious. Now that I'm thinking, I'm not thinking of my voice. But if I were trained to do it, of course, being in the theater, and strangely enough, when I project my voice, it takes on greater volume. That's from my training in the theater. I don't speak in my throat, but I was frightened to death. And when they took, of course, it was on records first, you know. And the playback, I went over to Paramount to make this test, and I turned to someone. I said, I don't sound like that. Well, I said, that sounds like a pipsqueak's voice. I said, that is terrible. And I said, do I sound like that? And they said, yes, but I said, it's impossible. It sounds like 12 or 13. And they said, oh, no, it's quite good. Oh, I said, it's horrible. Right then and there, I decided I wasn't going to do Coquette, but they talked me out of it. And, of course, I had seen that great performance of Helen Hayes in New York. She's a superb actress. And her diction is just wonderful. And, of course, I couldn't help but compare my voice with hers. Then I went ahead, of course, I think, knowing my career as well as you do, that I'd cut my hair off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wanted to be free of the shackles of curls and playing little girls. And I thought that was one step toward it. Of course, I had the most indignant letters, insulting letters. And I thought, well, if that's all, that after all these years and a lifetime in the theater and motion pictures, if it's a bunch of 18 curls that's keeping me on the screen, it's about time I retired. And another thing that happened then that nearly broke my heart was to say goodbye to Charlie Rocher. You know that he wouldn't, if there was a shadow on my face, it wouldn't matter if I were there with the King of England or the Queen of England. He'd stop grinding the camera. His devotion to me was so great that he wanted me to be perfect at every moment. And you know, when it came time to say goodbye to him, I didn't have the courage, the backbone, to face him. I left him a letter. And in this letter, if I recall correctly, I said, I'm determined to give a performance in this. It's a terrifically dramatic role. I'll have to cry a lot. I expect my nose to be red and swollen, my eyes swollen. I said, tragedy is an ugly picture. It's an ugly mask, as you know. The mask of tragedy is not attractive. And even the most beautiful songster, When he's quarreling, when he's frightened, makes unattractive sounds. I said, I don't care how I look. I'm going after the Oscar, and I want to give a performance for a change, and I don't want to look like something on a candy box or a Valentine. And I cannot do it unless I'm allowed full liberty. Well, I went out shopping with my mother and went back to the bungalow, and Charlie was pacing the floor. And, oh, he was so upset. And he said he never expected anything like that from me. And it seemed as though I didn't appreciate all of the devotion and the great contribution he'd made to my career. But I knew that he would interfere. He'd stop the camera at the wrong moment. He had done it before. And you know, when you get to a certain pitch, you may take a scene 10 times, 20 times. There'll be one take that'll be perfect. And if somebody stops you, then it's gone.
Yeah.
Like the time that Valentino walked down the stage when I was doing Little Annie Rooney. The scene where I think my father's come home. And it's a fellow officer to tell me my father's dead. I never did get that scene right. I could have killed myself. I couldn't rise to it. Because I was a 12-year-old girl until he walked on. Valentino and his friend from South America. I was glad to see him. But I tried to get back into that scene. I couldn't do it. I was Mary. I was not Annie. I walked up and down outside in agony. And the whole studio waited for me. I must have kept them waiting an hour and a half. I never got back into the mood. I tried to do it, but I was Annie when he came in. And that's what I felt about Charlie. Because once or twice, he'd stopped grinding, and I said, "What's the matter, Charlie?" He said, "There's an unattractive shadow across your nose." Well, I didn't weaken. I went right ahead with it. And we still remain friends. I love him, I respect him, I admire him, and I think he returns all of that.
I'm sure he does. He speaks very, very highly of you. Now we come to The Taming of the Shrew, and I don't think you were too happy with that one, were you?
No, I wasn't happy with it. In the first place, Shakespeare requires a great deal of study. It takes tremendous control of breath. And Shakespeare should be thought. All great Shakespearean actors think it. And as the more they think it, the better their diction, the better they are able to project what to the modern world is almost a foreign language. But my performance was a spitting kitten. It was a little kitten that said, "Shh, shh, shh." You know, I wake up in the night. And the encounter with Petruchio when he says, "Good morrow, Kate." And I said, Kate, they call me Catherine who do speak of me. Now, I'm not doing myself justice. But if I had it to say today, I'd say, Kate. They call me Catherine. Who do speak of me? Maybe that isn't good enough either. But you know, the bellows, it's the stomach. Everything comes from the stomach. Laughter, tears, hatred, everything comes from there. And deep down is Tigress. She could blast him. And when she gets into a temper, she should be very quiet. You come near me and I'll scratch your face. But I had none of that. I was breathing from the chest up and not from the stomach. I photographed fairly well, yes. On the other hand, I think Douglas gave a magnificent performance. Because he studied Shakespeare from the time he was 7. And it takes a flair. It takes gestures. It has to be broad. You have to fill the whole stage of the screen. And that comes from practice. And I wasn't fair to myself when I took Catherine on. I thought I'd be torn to pieces in London, but I wasn't. I deserved to be. Oh, I think so. Well, you know, I'm not allowed it to be, although it's a talking picture, I haven't allowed it to be shown on TV. Because I don't think it's fair to myself. I'm not going to ask the Mary of today or the Mary of yesteryear, rather, to compete with the actresses of today. That isn't fair to her. And, you know, I look upon her as my daughter. She worked hard that I might retire and live in security. And I have to protect her memory now.
Do we mention Kiki and Secrets, or don't we?
Well, Kiki, I love doing, but they were outraged at me for going around in my step-in, which, as I assure you, was quite respectable. A bikini I could understand, but it was triple line with chiffon. I was thoroughly underdressed. But, of course, she did stay in a man's apartment on the sofa overnight, and that was shocking to the admirers of Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm and poor little rich girl. You didn't like it either?
No, I'm just saying I'm one of the admirers, but I'm not shocked at Kiki.
Well, I'm sure Kiki would be as tame as Pollyanna today. Perhaps it was a little light, I don't know. I haven't seen it in years. I would like to see it again. Unfortunately for Secrets, it opened on the bank holiday in 1933. It opened in 25 cities on the very day that the bank holiday was declared. I think there are moments in Secrets that I'm quite proud of. I think the baby's death, for instance. There was one bad thing about Secrets. The transition from the middle-aged woman to the elderly woman was badly done. That's the greatest fault, one of the greatest faults in it. The montage of them going west is one of the finest I've ever seen that I had nothing to do with. A man by the name of Hoffman did it. And I think it is one of the most beautiful pieces of craftsmanship I've ever seen, of these covered wagons and the rain and the sandstorms and the hardships of these people, one on top of the other, showing how the West was won. And I don't think that Leslie Howard was a happy choice, but we couldn't help it. You could not imagine him conquering the desert. It should have been a Gable type, you know? But unfortunately, you just have to take what is available at the time. And while he's was, to my way of thinking, one of the supreme artists ever to appear on the screen, he was miscast. That was another fault of the picture. There goes the phone. Will you excuse me a second?